Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of subjects and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the hideous nuclear disaster in Japan and its consequences for the future of nuclear power and our future on this planet. Dr. Helen Caldicott joins us. She is the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility and the author of Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Then we'll do an update on a story that has been relegated to the back burner in spite of General Petraeus' testimony to Congress this week and polls that show a growing majority of Americans want us out of Afghanistan. We'll be joined by CNN's national security correspondent Peter Bergen, the author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by the filmmakers of a stunningly beautiful film that tells an extraordinary untold story. Amanda Pope and Shavdad Gurdjieff, the co-directors and producers of The Desert of Forbidden Art, a documentary feature that opens in LA at the Lemley Music Hall tomorrow, Friday, will tell us about this amazing art treasure now under threat from the Uzbek government. I'm speaking with the single most articulate and passionate advocate for citizens' action to remedy the nuclear environmental crisis. Dr. Helen Caldicott has devoted the last 38 years to an international campaign to educate the public about the medical hazards of the nuclear age and the necessary changes in human behavior to stop environmental destruction. She's the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility and was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Linus Pauling. Her books include If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Heal the Earth, and most recently, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Thank you so much for joining us here today, and obviously this is a very tragic time for the planet, and I think what's happening in Japan, from what I've been able to learn over the last few days, is so much worse than what we've been told in our mainstream press that I sometimes wonder whether I'm living in an alternative universe.
Yes, well, the problem is we've been trying to educate the media for years, Ian, and they've simply been uninterested, and I've always said it will take a meltdown for people to understand exactly what I'm talking about, but by then it's too late, and that's what's happening right now.
Well, it seems like that not only do we have four of these six reactors at Fukushima in various stages of meltdown, and the radiation apparently now is so high that it's almost impossible to get people to stay on the site to deal with these cascading problems. The latest one in Reactor 4 appears to be that the swimming pool full of spent fuel rods and not spent fuel rods that were put in there during maintenance of Reactor 4, which was offline, they're going critical. So
they were very hot fuel rods that have just been put in the core. If they've been put from the core into the pool, they're very hot.
They're very hot, but there's no water apparently in the pool. So they're just in the atmosphere. That's exactly what happened at Chernobyl. You had fissile material because that reactor was hot when it melted down.
Yeah, and there's much more radiation in the cooling pools, as you say, they're euphemistically called swimming pools, than there is in the core of the reactor itself. It's a scenario that is almost beyond comprehension. I've described a very good Princeton study by von Hippel et al. In my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, about a cooling pool meltdown. So it's much, much, by orders of magnitude, worse than Chernobyl. The New York Academy of Sciences has just come out with a report on Chernobyl where they translated 5,000 Russian articles for the first time into English, and the estimate is that nearly a million people have died now from Chernobyl, and that's been a massive cover-up conspiracy by the nuclear industry, massive. 40% of the European landmass is still radioactive and will remain so for hundreds of years. I don't buy European food now. Turkey got a hell of a lot of radiation. But this is by orders of magnitude much worse.
Why do you think they've got away with it for so long? I just was...
Look, it's complex, Ian. To understand the biological effects of radiation, and actually I've just given grand rounds in Camden Hospital in New Jersey to a lot of my colleagues, pediatricians, neonatologists. We're not taught this stuff in medical school. We are taught that radiation causes mutations and cancer. But we're not taught about the various isotopes released in nuclear power plants. We're not taught about alpha emitters that are so incredibly carcinogenic, like plutonium, uranium, and the like. We're not taught about beta emitters, and we're not taught about internal emitters. And by the way, they're running around with Geiger counters now in Japan. None of the official monitors are working around the nuclear power stations because either tsunami destroyed them or they were turned off, and they're only measuring gamma radiation. Now, gamma is emitted by some of the elements released, that's like X-rays, but also they're not measuring the alpha or beta radiation, and some of the isotopes only emit alpha and beta, and in fact, they're almost the most dangerous. So the measurements we're getting are just, well, I could use a rude Australian expression, Ian, but I won't, but they're totally inadequate.
This boiling water Mark 1 General Electric reactor, 40 years old, we're now learning that the original designers quit GE in disgust because they didn't think it was a safe reactor. It was designed...
Dale Bridenwell. Hubbard and Miner?
Yes.
Yeah, they were my friends. Fantastic men. Yeah, they were so worried about it. Yes, they resigned from GE.
And then the first head of the Atomic Energy Commission said that this was too dangerous to license, and yet somehow it got licensed. And we have 31 of these I think 26 or 23 are operating here in the United States. And, of course, the ones in Japan were also reaching the end of their life. They've just extended one of them up in Vermont that the legislature and the governor voted to be shut down, but yet the NRC just relicensed it just before this accident.
I know. This
is the extraordinary disconnect. There's got to be some peculiar, and we know our president is sticking by his pledge for $36 billion more in federal loan guarantees.
Well, Ian, I need half an hour with that president. He's got two little children that he adores. And he's hearing only from Stephen Chu, who is a physicist, and from John Holden, his science advisor, who's in favor of nuclear power. He must talk to a physician, a pediatrician. If I had half an hour with him, I could turn him round. But I don't know how to get to him. I don't know.
Well, do you think, though, that the revelations that are coming out, albeit with the press that's been heavily influenced by nuclear happy talk, I mean, reality eventually does. Of course, we all pay a price, but when reality does eventually trump propaganda.
This is the end of the nuclear power industry, Ian. It's the end of uranium mining in Australia. This is the end. And I also hope the Ramans move on to nuclear weapons, because Obama's just granted the nuclear weapons industry $85 billion to build new nuclear weapons, and that was the price he paid for getting the Senate and Senator Kyle to agree to ratify the New START treaty he had negotiated with the Russians. The whole thing is, it's nuclear madness. It's what I called my first book years ago.
Well, do you feel that over the years, we have to admit though, because we first met back in the late 70s when you were demonstrating at Rocky Flats.
Yes.
And the good news, I guess, in the intervening years has been the end of the Cold War. But
yeah, I know, but the weapon, that didn't fix a thing, Ian. The nuclear weapons are still on hair trigger alert, ready to blow up the world with a computer error or by a hacker or by some crazy person pressing the button or by, you know, misrepresenting an early warning system that's actually false. So we still live on the precipice of annihilation every second of every day. And then we've got this to contend with. Do we end with a whimper or a bang?
Well, if we go back to 45 and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which, of course, needless to say, happened in Japan, there is this feeling that out of this kind of guilt trip, we decided to embrace the friendly atom in this idea that there was something good about nuclear.
Well, we didn't. It was the nuclear physicists, many of whom I knew, who designed the bombs during the Manhattan Project, and their guilt was so profound, having killed and vaporized over 200,000 people, that they thought they could assuage their guilt by harnessing the atom for peaceful purposes. But even they knew how dangerous the whole thing was. And as Einstein said, the splitting of the atom changed everything, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. How profound is that? And Einstein also said, nuclear power's a hell of a way to boil water.
And, of course, the reactors that are melting down in Japan are the boiling water reactors Mark 1, designed by General Electric over 40 years ago.
And General Electric builds nuclear weapons and missiles. You know, it's into it right up to its neck. It's into the death industry. It's a death dealer. Builds good things for life like fridges, irons, stoves, nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants.
And I guess I don't know what the situation in Japan will be in terms of liability. But if they end up, that's a very small country. I mean, a huge swath of the Ukraine is uninhabitable as a result of Chernobyl. If this is worse than Chernobyl, it's almost mind-boggling to comprehend or to...
Oh, it's terrible. And as I watch the pictures of the people struggling through the ruins of the tsunami and earthquake, it looks just like the pictures after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, acute radiation sickness was first described as a syndrome after those bombs were dropped, because we had never seen anything like it before. People were just dying of sort of unknown causes, bleeding to death and vomiting and diarrhea within 2 weeks after the bombs dropped, and we couldn't understand it. And now, for God's sake, the Japanese are experiencing this all over again. I mean, I tremble in my boots for Japan. And then, of course, the winds blow from west to east, and it's going to dump, I think, on America.
When you say that you think these unfolding accidents, disasters in Japan, about which we still don't know the full scope of how much radiation is going out, but if indeed these empty swimming pools full of rods that are now going critical because there's no coolant, what gives you the confidence, Dr. Helen Caldicott, that this hideous disaster in Japan that's unfolding will bring about the end of nuclear power?
That's my prediction, Ian, and I'm usually right, unfortunately. Well, this time, fortunately.
And so you think that it's just so hideous that
They
can't pretend that this stuff is containable and can cohabit with civilization and with the planet?
Nope.
And what do you think about the possibility of some of this stuff drifting to the United States?
Oh, high possibility.
They just, as I say, they just licensed the plant in Vermont a week before this accident.
But I've been heavily involved in Vermont. The governor is dead against it. The legislature is dead against it. It's not going to happen.
So,
especially now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but
all the reactors in America, 104 of them, should be closed down overnight. I mean, that's medically indicated. I'm now speaking as a physician.
But the president has stood by his pledge for $36 billion.
Yeah, but he's wrong. And think of the people in Wisconsin. Think of Egypt. If we rise up, we'll get our own way. It's just we've got to get off our couches. Leave our blasted computers. Joining Facebook does nothing about the political situation. We've got to get out and take over Congress. That's our building. We paid for it. We pay for those politicians. We go and occupy it, like they have done in Wisconsin. Nothing less will fix it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Thanks, Ian.
I was speaking then with Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She was personally nominated for the Nobel Prize by Linus Pauling. Her earlier book was If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Heal the Earth, and her latest book is Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. We'll take a brief station break and be back talking about Afghanistan that has receded from the headlines.
Oh, this world is at a tremble with its strength and mighty power. They're sending up to heaven to get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother, be careful how you plan. You're working with the power of God's own holy hand. Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty hand of
I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, who is the author of the new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Peter Bergen is CNN's national security analyst and the director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. He has traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and recently Egypt. In 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN. Peter Bergen's other books include Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden, and The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Bergen.
Thank you for the invitation, Ian.
Since you were just in Egypt and all of these revolutions that are roiling the Middle East and North Africa, I get a certain perverse pleasure out of it, in as much as these tectonic shifts in the politics of that region have marginalized Al-Qaeda, marginalized the Likud, and marginalized a lot of the left's favorite revolutionaries like Chavez and Ortega and Castro and, I suppose, to some extent, Ahmadinejad. Do you in any way share that feeling?
Well, it's also marginalized, you know, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Both on the kind of extreme right and the left, what's going on in Egypt. You know, what's interesting is that we've had polling data from around the Muslim world in, you know, great volume in the past decade, and surprise, surprise, Muslims around the Muslim world want exactly kind of what everybody else wants. They want an accountable government, some measure of prosperity, free press, independent judiciary. These are kind of classic kind of liberal values. And what they don't want is the Taliban.
But the interesting shoe that might drop, I spoke to a Saudi human rights dissident the other day, is Saudi Arabia. And of course, the Saudis have often been referred to as the Taliban with oil.
Well, you know, that's the big enchilada. There are all sorts of reasons why Saudi Arabia might be more, or is more stable, and might prove more stable in the future. One, of course, is King Abdullah, who's arguably the most impressive Saudi king since King Faisal, and is widely loved and revered. I've spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia, and you know, even people who are in the political opposition like King Abdullah. Second, of course, they have a lot of money they can bribe people with in one form or another. Thirdly, they are the quote-unquote defender of the holy places, a title they assumed in 1986. And of course, they are closely linked to the Al Saud, which is the Wahhabi religious family, which is effectively the second royal family in the Saudi Arabia. It's the alliance between the Wahhabis and the Sauds that has gone on since the 18th century. And of course, this is the third Saudi monarchy. There's been three different sets of Al Saud monarchies since this 18th century. So all those things together suggest that Saudi Arabia is not Bahrain. The Shia population is relatively small. That said, of course, you know, it is a absolute monarchy. They've made some minor changes. I was there in 2005 when they had the first election they've had for a long time in Saudi Arabia, but it was only a municipal election in Riyadh, the capital. And so they must be looking at all this thinking, what do we need to do? And of course, King Abdullah is in poor health, and his immediate potential successors are all in their 80s. And I think the Saudi royal family must be doing some serious soul-searching about what is the next best way forward.
There's been some rumors for some time that Prince Nayef and his son, Prince Mohammed, the interior minister and his sidekick, have been running the show while Abdullah's been sick, and he's widely despised within the kingdom. So if he succeeds Abdullah, then I think there would be a lot of discontent.
I'm not sure he's widely despised. I mean, what gives you that
belief? Oh, that was the impression that I got from the Saudis that I've spoken to, particularly these human rights people. But
well,
they
run the interior ministry, and so that, of course, would be. But I've met, you know, the Prince Nayef Senior again is in his 80s.
Right.
Whatever happens to King Abdullah, the next king is going to be very much an interim king, and they're going to have to go down to the next generation. Prince Nayef Jr. is actually, I think, quite an impressive guy who might well be the next king if, you know, in terms of a longer term succession. Of course, and they decide this by consensus. It's not primogeniture in a sort of British monarchical sense. It can skip generations, and people have to agree on who the next king will be. It's not necessarily just because you're the oldest.
Well, just getting onto your book, Peter, the subtitle suggests, and many people have suggested this, that we've been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic.
Well, you know, he certainly would like to make it an endless war. I call the book The Longest War simply because it is the longest war in American history. It's certainly not the most important war. The Civil War, World War II, the Cold War, even the Vietnam War are all more important than this war. But it's the one we're in right now. And certainly bin Laden sees it as a generational struggle. You know, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, has said in his sort of autobiography that it took two centuries to get the Crusaders out of the Middle East. It took 140 years to get the French out of Algeria. You know, that's the kind of timeline that, you know, these guys are not concerned about. Next year, they're playing a long game. But it's a game that they're losing.
Your book begins with the months preceding September 11th, 2001, and I'm Peter Bergen. I'm absolutely mystified how this truth movement developed in this country, and in a curious way, the truthers who believe that 9/11 was an inside job and that Bush and Cheney are these evil geniuses, they actually, to my mind, are dignifying Bush and Cheney, who in your book clearly could be charged with the reckless endangerment of the United States for ignoring manifest evidence.
Yeah, well, certainly incompetence. You know, I mean, Occam's razor is a pretty useful philosophical tool to look at any human endeavor, which is the simplest explanation is probably the best one. And incompetence is usually a better explanation of almost every human activity than conspiracy. Conspiracy implies far too much competence in the human beings, who are by their nature not usually very competent. And certainly the Bush administration, you know, fell down. I say in the book that the 9/11 Commission, which did this amazing piece of historical research and was sort of designed not to assign particular culpability to particular people, it was really designed to look at institutional culpabilities, of which there were plenty of culpabilities to go around. But because it was bipartisan, it didn't really take a position on who on the Bush administration really was asleep at the switch. But if you read the footnotes of the 9/11 report, there's a ton of really good, interesting evidence in those footnotes, emails that went to Condoleezza Rice from various of the counterterrorism people inside the National Security Council. You know, the numbers of cabinet meetings devoted to terrorism before 9/11 were only 1 out of 33. You know, there's an avalanche of evidence showing that, contrary to what Condoleezza Rice said when she testified before the 9/11 Commission, that the Bush administration was at battle stations in the summer of 2001. In fact, they were far from at battle stations, and in fact, President Bush took the longest presidential vacation in 3 decades in the summer of 2001, despite all the information that was coming in to the CIA and even to him, that things were, you know, that there was a big plot afoot.
But Peter Bergen, in your book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, you do recount the battle for Tora Bora as the single most consequential battle in the war on terror. And without getting conspiratorial, it is still mystifying why Rumsfeld kept blocking requests from the special forces people on the ground to block bin Laden's exit. I mean, what's your final conclusion on that? I mean, I know...
Well, my final conclusion was based on an email interview I conducted with General Tommy Franks, in which he said, yes, that request did come up the chain from the CIA leader, Hank Crumpton, who was running in the Afghan operation, which had been in turn precipitated by the CIA guy on the ground, Gary Burnson. And, you know, they were requesting a Ranger battalion, i.e. 800 soldiers, to come in and help try and kind of tamp down the Tora Bora area, because they knew bin Laden was there. I mean, there was multiple sources of evidence that bin Laden was there. The U.S. Special Forces official history of the battle, which I drew upon, says that between December 9th and 14th, 2001, there were multiple sources of intelligence, mostly radio intercepts, that bin Laden was actually at Tora Bora. And at one point, you know, U.S. soldiers were only perhaps 2 kilometers from his, they could use direction finding technology to see where he was. And Franks basically has said that he didn't approve more soldiers because he was concerned about more American soldiers on the ground being antibodies for the Afghans, that the intelligence on bin Laden's presence at Tora Bora wasn't very clear, which, by the way, is nonsensical, and a number of other things. But the point is that, or, you know, just as an aside, in Tommy Franks' defense, you know, Rumsfeld went to him right at the height of the Battle of Tora Bora and told him to rewrite the war plan for Iraq. Now, the war plan for Iraq at that time was an 800-page document, and they had a week to rewrite it in, you know, and they were already working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. So the fact is that what had worked very well to overthrow the Taliban, limited numbers of U.S. special forces on the ground, supported by CIA officers and, you know, thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers, failed at the Battle of Tora Bora.
Well, just to go back a little bit before this, I hosted a forum at the UCLA Hammer Forum recently with a very experienced anthropologist in Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, and the head of the Pashto service for VOI, Spasmai Maywandi. And she's the only person to have interviewed Mullah Omar both before and after 9/11. And they were talking about how Mullah Omar had, in fact, offered up bin Laden to Prince Turki, who's Prince Nayef's predecessor, head of Saudi intelligence, and that Saudis didn't want this guy, and they wanted the Americans to get him. What's your understanding of that? In other words, was this looks like a missed opportunity to have prevented 9/11? In other words, there's no way that Mullah Omar...
My friend and colleague and boss, Steve Cole, has literally written the book on this, and,
right.
And whether in Ghost Wars or in the 9/11 Commission report, that's a slightly garbled version of what actually happened. The Saudis were quite keen to get bin Laden, and Prince Turki, you know, went to Afghanistan and did some negotiation. And at one point, Mullah Omar said he would hand over bin Laden. But then the embassy attacks happened in Africa. The United States responded with cruise missiles. And after that, Mullah Omar basically changed his mind about expelling bin Laden. So there were plenty of missed opportunities along the way, whether it was the Saudis trying to get bin Laden out of Afghanistan, or whether it was a series of plans to snatch or kill bin Laden using cruise missiles or CIA assets on the ground.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. But in the broader sense, do you think, Peter Bergen, that Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabis that you were talking about earlier have had a profound effect on radicalizing Pakistan and Afghanistan? And how would you compare that to bin Laden's effect?
It's a very complicated question because, you know, there are tens of millions of Saudis who wouldn't describe themselves as Wahhabis. They would describe themselves as perhaps Salafis or just, you know, fundamentalists in their religion. And, you know, very, very few of them have gone on to engage in violence, relatively speaking. On the other hand, Al-Qaeda, according to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in the operational commander of 9/11, he has said that something like 70% of the recruits coming to Al-Qaeda's training camps were coming from Saudi Arabia. So certainly Saudi Arabia has had many of the key members of Al-Qaeda have come out of Saudi Arabia. And that's just a fact. And of course, Al-Qaeda in the Saudi Arabia was a very virulent organization, which mounted a very violent campaign against the Saudi government and the Saudi population beginning in May of 2003, as a result of which the Saudi government arrested thousands of people, killed 150 jihadist terrorists, really mounted a very, very successful campaign against Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, which has basically been defeated. So there's a lot of paradoxes here, because Al-Qaeda, at the end of the day, what do they want? They want to get rid of the Saudi regime. That's their main goal. And so the idea that the Saudis have been instrumental in the rise of Al-Qaeda would be kind of strange if they were promoting something that was actually interested in their own demise.
So do you think the emphasis on madrasas and the money that's poured in and refugee camps that became the kind of breeding ground for a lot of the Taliban, you know, I keep hearing, in spite of a lot of evidence to the contrary, that a lot of people insist that there are links between, an ideological comfort zone, if you will, between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban leadership?
Well, there are. I mean, it depends which part of the Taliban you're talking about. The Haqqani network, which is based in North Waziristan in Pakistani's tribal regions, is protecting Al-Qaeda right now, and the Haqqani network is arguably the most effective of the Taliban militia groups. On the other hand, you know, the Mullah Omar group, which is in southern Afghanistan and western Pakistan, their ties to Al-Qaeda are much less clear, and so it depends which element of the Taliban you're talking about with. But as a general principle, the Taliban has protected Al-Qaeda and continues to do so. So there's certainly some commonality of goals to some degree there. And in fact, the Pakistani Taliban, as you well know, sent a suicide bomber to Times Square in May of 2010. And so here you've got the Taliban acting in a much more like Al-Qaeda-like manner.
But the Haqqani network is also very connected to the ISI, isn't it?
It is.
There's a sense now, at least, there's been some indications that the CIA, either contractor or officer, who is under arrest in Pakistan, may have shot a couple of ISI operatives. So it may be a kind of spy war going on here between the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency of Pakistan and the CIA.
Yeah, I don't really know. But clearly this story of Raymond Davis, the CIA contractor who shot and killed two Pakistanis, is a huge story in Pakistan, and already the Pakistani-American relationship is never really that great, and this has really put a huge dent in it.
But they are certainly, the ISI is certainly connected to or protecting Haqqani, right? I mean, would that be?
Yeah, I mean, they are, yeah, it's all very murky, but they are at least acquiescing in their continued existence and maybe even supporting in some respects their operations against India and Afghanistan. For instance, the attack on the Indian embassy was a Haqqani network plan and may have had some ISI support, according to both U.S. and Afghan officials.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, his new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. We are discussing it in a very important work in terms of not just America's reaction to 9/11, but also reveals a lot of what happened on the other side, if you will, how splits are evident and enduring amongst Al-Qaeda, bin Laden has made mistakes, according to a lot of them, and killing a lot of Muslims. But also from the, there was a fundamental difference over tactics versus strategy. Is that, I guess that continues, right, in terms of whether attacking America was worth losing the haven in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, bin Laden is a smart guy. He's intelligent, he's well-informed, but that doesn't make him a great strategist. And his strategy of attacking the United States on 9/11 was to get the United States to pull out of the Middle East, and the authoritarian regimes like the Mubarak regime and the Saudi regime would then fall. And he based that analysis on the idea that the United States was as weak as the Soviet Union. So once the Soviet Union fell, its client regimes in Eastern Europe also fell. But that was a very naive analysis of the United States. And just because we pulled out of the Vietnam and pulled out of Beirut in the 80s and pulled out of Somalia in the 90s didn't mean that we're going to pull out of the Middle East because we were attacked in New York and Washington. And of course, quite the reverse happened. We had occupied Afghanistan, occupied Iraq, drew closer to the Saudis and to the Mubarak regime based on our shared goal of defeating Al-Qaeda. And so bin Laden's entire strategy didn't make any sense. And there were some smart people in Al-Qaeda, even before 9/11, who were telling him attacking the United States actually might be kind of a dumb idea. And one of the people I interview in the book, you know, talked to him directly in the summer of 2001, essentially saying, do not attack the United States. It's really would be very counterproductive for our immediate goal, which is to basically get rid of these dictatorships and monarchies in the Middle East. Well, and in fact, it turned out that it was people power that did it in the Middle East, and that was nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and had nothing to do with the attack on 9/11.
And that, of course, Peter Bergen, isn't a supreme irony, given bin Laden's rather bizarre analysis of what was happening, that the ripe fruit that would fall to his caliphate, if you will, when in fact they appear to be falling to some social media-driven desire for democracy in connection with the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's a great irony, and I'm sure bin Laden isn't enjoying savoring it. You've had Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, has released, I think, three or four tapes now trying to insert Al-Qaeda into the events that are going on in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East, and they're basically a big dud. No one's paying any attention to them.
Can you make the case that we've been wrong-footed from the beginning with 9/11? There, after all, in New York, where the funeral pyre was still smoldering, we could have organized the UN, and after all, the best way to get terrorists abroad is through cooperation with the host countries. Instead, we sort of went it alone. President Bush declared this war on terror, and in doing so, he appeared to elevate bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage, and there were allusions to him being the next Hitler, etc., and that we have also conflated bin Laden with jihadis and the very notion of jihad having a religious connotation, why we never call him a criminal as opposed to somebody on a spiritual quest. And it just seems like our missteps are the gift that keep on giving.
Well, we've certainly made some missteps, but Al-Qaeda has made a whole set of missteps which it hasn't learned from. So, you know, I agree with you. I mean, I think one of President Bush's main conceptual errors was to turn Al-Qaeda into the existential threat it hoped to be rather than the actual real enough threat it was. And sort of when he spoke to the nation and to Congress 9 days after 9/11, he implied that this was similar to the fight against fascism or communism, and that just didn't make any sense. The Nazis instigated a global conflict that killed tens of millions of people. With the Cold War, it ended with a bang instead of a whimper. You and I and everybody listening to this conversation would have been dead, and so that's really existential. Al-Qaeda was a threat, but it's not an existential threat. And there were some good things about the way Bush handled it. The plan in Afghanistan was quite a thoughtful one with George Tenet, but a lot of mistakes were also made, coercive interrogations, denying the Geneva Conventions at Guantanamo. They were unnecessary, counterproductive, and it turned out the Supreme Court said they were also not legal. And so many mistakes were made, but as a society, the United States has learned from its mistakes. And as a group, Al-Qaeda doesn't really learn from its mistakes. It just kind of keeps on going. And violence is its only real kind of calling card. And the tactics have taken over the strategy. It doesn't really have a real strategy. It's just calling for more violence and Taliban-style regimes from Indonesia to Morocco, and it turns out that most Muslims don't want any part of that. They saw what the Taliban looked like in action in Afghanistan, and they're not impressed.
But when will we stop taking our shoes off at the airports?
I think we'll be continuing that forever. I mean, once these security things are in place, they're very hard to stop. And of course, just because Al-Qaeda may be losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world doesn't mean some other terrorist group may not want to put a bomb on a plane, either packed into somebody's sneakers or a plastic explosive or whatever. I mean, Al-Qaeda is not the only group of violent nihilists out there. There are others.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Peter Bergen.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Peter Bergen, who is the author of the new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda.
I found these paintings rolled up under the beds of old widows, buried in family trash. These were forbidden works by artists who stayed true to their vision at a terrible cost.
I'm speaking with Amanda Pope and Chabjar Gyuliev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film, The Desert of Forbidden Art. And Amanda, you directed it, and Chabjar, you produced it.
No, we all did it together.
You did
totally,
it together.
Yeah, that's the great thing. Across generations, Ian.
So there were no pulling rank and ego conflicts?
Absolutely not, you know.
Well, it's shocking.
A shock. It is a beautiful film. I mean, the art, of course, is where the beauty resides. And even on the screen, it just overwhelms you.
Especially on the screen. This is where we had some wonderful fortune technologically, because this HD medium really makes the art look gorgeous. It really makes the colors pop out.
And this museum is so far out there in the desert that this is an incredible opportunity for American audiences to see this art.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary about this whole extraordinary story of the desert of forbidden art, this hidden treasure in this remote part of Uzbekistan, in a town that I had never heard of. And there you have this extraordinary treasure that's been preserved by this sort of unusual Russian.
Protected, really. Protected both by the man who, Igor Savitsky, who rescued the art, and also by the present director, who Savitsky turned over the directorship of the museum to when she was 26.
What's really interesting that a lot of people, even in Russia, haven't heard about this city, Nukus, which is in the middle of the Karakum and Kizilkum Desert, very far away from any kind of big centers. And that is what enabled Igor Savitsky to start collecting this art, because there nobody knew what he had.
Sure.
This was the only museum in the Soviet Union that was exhibiting illegal art bought on government money and prominently featured on display.
Well, that, of course, is the genius of this subversive man, was that he went down there in the 20s, I think it was, as an anthropologist. And
50s. He was there in the 50s, though originally he was an art student. In World War II, he was evacuated from Moscow as an art student, which is what the Soviets did, which is quite wonderful. All their art community, they evacuated to the south to protect them.
In the 50s, then, he starts building this museum. He somehow cons these apparatchiks into giving him all this money. He then goes and rescues these treasures that were banned by Stalin as bourgeois art, and actually managed to provide the widows and orphans of these great artists some kind of stipend. And then he gets it all in the train and the trucks and brings back. And now you have this amazing treasure in the middle of nowhere, put together by this interesting fellow and preserved by this equally interesting woman that you profile in your film, The Desert of Forbidden Art. And now I learned from last Tuesday's New York Times that this great art treasure is in danger yet again. It survived Stalin, but is it going to survive the Uzbek bureaucrats?
Well, just to give you an idea, this is the second largest collection of Russian avant-garde art in the world, and it has over 40,000 paintings and graphics.
And what's fascinating is not all of them are masterpieces, because you have to know that Igor Savitsky was obsessive, deeply obsessive. I mean, anyone who single-handedly, he didn't have money of his own. He didn't have, you know, he didn't have a whole crew of people. He brought those paintings rolled up by the thousands with him. He carried them on his back. And people used to think he was a porter. And then he got them down there, framed them. He had individual IOUs. And when he died, we found his doctor living here in Los Angeles. And Dr. Funi said that as he was dying, Savitsky said, "I can't die. I owe over ₹1 million." And Maronika, the present director's first job for the first 15 years that she was director of that museum, was to pay back the IOUs.
And this is in a new post-Soviet environment where this art is now suddenly incredibly valuable. You have a lot of Russian billionaires, right? And they'd like to get their whole hands on some of this stuff, and they're trying. Is that right?
You're absolutely right, Ian. We get phone calls from Russian oligarchs every now and then. And what is amazing is they don't take no for an answer. All they know is how much, and we'll call you next week. And we try to explain that all we're trying to do is preserve this collection and bring the world's attention to what's going there at the moment, which is rather unfortunate.
So, Amanda, is the value of this collection the subtext for this bizarre behavior on the part of the Uzbek government that now they've essentially run trucks up to the back of the building, taken this stuff out, saying that the building's condemned even though it's in perfectly good shape? Have they fired this wonderful woman that's preserved this collection?
No. The reality is there were two museum buildings. The one that they have condemned was the original building that Savitsky had, which was from 1966, and it wasn't in the greatest shape. When you saw them pouring water under trays to give the proper humidity to the paintings, I mean, we're not talking about high-class air conditioning. But on the other hand, what was so valuable about this building is that the storage rooms were there, the restoration lab was there, and also a number of paintings that the Uzbek government had indicated to the director they would just as soon not have go on display. They are in that old museum. And so the real issue is what we hope our film and this media attention can cause is for the Uzbek government to adopt a progressive attitude and say, hey, wait a minute, this is a major tourist attraction, rather than disapproving of it because so many of the artists are Russian and the Russians were the Uzbeks' former colonials. Why don't we just say, hey, folks, we have the Silk Road masterpiece cities, and now you have the Savitsky collection in the desert. Come and see them all. And, you know, they can laugh all the way to the bank. It's tourist dollars.
So, Chavda, do you think that they're safe or there's not going to be another peculiar kind of purge? Or?
Well, at the moment, the works are safe, even though a lot of them are stored literally in the hallways of the new building. But in a larger scope, 97% of the collection is in dire need of restoration. And now with the restoration lab gone, there's not even any plans for this work continuing. Uzbekistan as a country is in a very volatile region in Central Asia. It borders on Afghanistan, and there's some Islamic fundamentalism next door. And this is a collection of 20th century contemporary non-representational art.
Sure, and then there's a sequence in the film where the Taliban blow up the Buddhas in Bamiyan, and it just shocks you when you see that, and you're reminded of that, and you know that that impulse is there. So it is tenuous, right? And what about all this sudden publicity that your film has brought it and the New York Times has brought it? What kind of protection does that provide?
Well, just to update your listeners, not only was the building vacated at a 40-hour notice, but the director of the museum was forbidden from coming to the United States for the opening of the film at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, which was an incredible honor for the Uzbek government and for the achievements of Uzbekistan in preserving this collection, but she was not allowed to travel.
Was the Uzbek ambassador there?
No. I mean, the Uzbek government, 2 weeks before she was going to come, she had her ticket, she had her U.S. visa, and she was forbidden to travel. And indirect approaches were made to us about the possibility of the Uzbek diplomats coming to the screening at the Wharton National Gallery. And what we said is what you have to be prepared for if you come is there are going to be questions about why your government has forbidden, you know, the director from coming here. It was such a wonderful event honoring Uzbekistan, you know, and honoring the culture. But, you know, they're progressive forces in the country and they're reactionary forces. And what we hope the film will do, and in answer to your question, the publicity, is to let the Uzbek government see how much interest there is and encourage them to support this museum rather than try and,
It feels, though, more like a Soviet impulse than an Islamist one or a corrupt oligarchical one in terms of the new political mix there. Again, I'm speaking with Amanda Pope and Shavdar Gyulyev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film Together, The Desert of Forbidden Art, an extraordinary film that brings to life these art treasures that Stalin banned and that were rescued by this amazing Russian former anthropologist turned art collector that ended up in this museum in the middle of nowhere in the new Republic of Uzbekistan. Is it possible, though, Shavdar, that there was a little bit of a reaction to the... I thought it was so tragic that the Uzbek artist that became one of Stalin's favorites, because he did all that neorealistic stuff that they love, you know, the brave tractor driver and all that stuff, his earlier works are just spectacular. I mean, they just, they're, I mean, I'm looking at your video and I can't believe how beautiful they are. And then, of course, he became successful as a propagandist, not a painter. And he returns finally to see his work, this extraordinary work that was saved by this Russian. And at this point, he has a chauffeured limousine and it drives him all the way to the museum. And guess what happens? He has a heart attack before he gets to see his earlier works. Such a poetic irony.
We couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, reality is so much more interesting than what you can make up. I mean, what we had to do is reenact that scene. And we found an 80-year-old man here in Los Angeles who had a Dodge car that was exactly the model that the Soviets had for their cars in that period. And Chavi had a friend who was a sculptor who made us an authentic Soviet license plate.
Well, you fooled me. I tell you, I thought, boy... How do they get this footage?
But what's really interesting, he has a museum to himself with a communist monument in front of it, a communist statue of himself, and a medal for being a hero of the Soviet Union. And inside this museum, there's two stories of paintings, two floors of paintings, but none of them are at the level of the works, over 600 incredible, fauvist, beautiful, colorful works of Tansigbaev, of Ural Tansigbaev on Central Asia and the Silk Road. And what also was very interesting, as we saw his photographs as a young man, he was a very thin-looking young man. And as he grew older and became more socialist, realist, and showered by the government with all kinds of honors and awards, he grew in size.
Right.
So in the film, we refer to him as the fat cat.
But it feels like his soul was eroded over the years. And that's what I'm wondering about, whether there is this sort of embarrassment amongst the former Soviet elite who have essentially become the ruling cliques, haven't they, in these countries? They're former Soviet apparatchiks who are now running the place. Is there an element of that they're embarrassed by their past? Is that possible?
No.
Or maybe these people aren't capable of embarrassment.
They're very realistic people, kind of down to earth. I mean, indeed, the president of Uzbekistan was the first secretary of the Communist Party before the fall of the Soviet Union. But the artists themselves, it is incredible that they stay true to their vision despite all odds, they were persecuted, thrown in gulags, in mental hospitals, because surely if they pay into works like this, they must be deranged.
Right.
Some of them were even shot for things like believing in God or for homosexuality. This was considered a crime in the Soviet Union. But despite all of those odds, they stayed true to their vision. And the irony is that the Soviet Union is gone, and now their works are worth millions of dollars.
The film is opening
the 18th here at the Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And I should say one thing that is kind of wonderful. Here, this whole story could not have been made were we not connected with USC. I'm on the faculty there. Chavi was my former student. John Bolt, who is the foremost authority on Russian avant-garde, he's in Slavic languages. And USC really encouraged the whole project. And so it's kind of marvelous because, you know, you don't think of the Trojans in Nukus in the Karakum Desert, but, you know, we get around.
Right. Well, it would be the equivalent of what having the Museum of Modern Art in whereabouts, somewhere in the New Mexico desert or something. Yeah, like Los Alamos, I guess.
South Dakota.
South Dakota, that's even better. Right, South Dakota. So just in closing, though, I'm curious as to whether in Russia itself, in Moscow, amongst the new capitalists, there's any kind of movement to rescue this art, to preserve it, or to even to bring it back to Moscow. What's the explanation for what appears to be an absence of interest on the part of the new Russians, and the only people that seem to care about this stuff are here in America and in other parts of the world.
Oh, the new Russians are very interested in
it. Yeah, they can get their hands on it.
And as Marinika, the director of the museum, says, they have very good taste. They're usually after the best works, and they know exactly which ones those are. We only hope the film hasn't screened in Russia, only in one place. And we only hope that the attention it's getting in the West will make Russians appreciate their own cultural treasure that is now in Uzbekistan.
But it should be preserved for Russians to see, not for billionaires to hang in their private palaces.
We have a story like this in the film where a painting that is not from the Nukus Museum is sold at an auction in Moscow. It's by one of the major artists of the museum, but it's from a private collection. And the son of the artist says that now the painting is sold. We don't know who has it. We don't know when people would ever be able to enjoy it again. We don't know where it is anymore.
Right, and he mentions makes an allusion to Van Gogh. This artist had nothing during his lifetime, and now his art's worth hundreds, millions of dollars, right?
But you notice when that son made that remark, he didn't say, oh, this painting was sold for $500,000 and our family didn't get any of it. That was not the remark he made. The remark he made was now the public cannot see it. Now people cannot see it. And that is really such an expression of the true Russian love of art.
Right, and which couldn't have been more embodied by this extraordinary man that you profile in the film, Igor Savitsky. Thank you both for joining us in the studio.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Pope and Shavdar Gilyev, who wrote, produced, and directed the new documentary film, The Desert of Forbidden Art, opening March 18th here in Los Angeles at the Lemley. This new documentary, The Desert of Forbidden Art, will also be offered as a KPFK Film Club selection when it's released in Los Angeles on March the 18th. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments, and I would love to know what you think. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.